welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. We live in an age of specialization. With more knowledge about specific topics, you can often move up the ladder of success in our modern, technologically advanced society. There's nowhere this is more true than medicine, where we have surgeons who focus on just arms, while their counterparts focus on legs. Eye surgeons might focus exclusively on the cornea, others on the retina. These are but two examples. With advanced knowledge can come expertise, but what constitutes mastery? According to my guest today, experts know all or most of the answers, but masters know what questions to keep asking. How can an expert, like a doctor, maintain the wonder and curiosity of a beginner? What advantages are there to doing so? Ronald Epstein is a family physician, palliative care physician, writer, researcher, and teacher of communication and mindful practice in medicine. He also discovered Buddhism and transcendental meditation as a teenager, which led him on an epic life journey. His new book is called Attending: Medicine, Mindfulness, and Humanity. Dr. Ron Epstein of the University of Rochester is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Dr. Ron Epstein, welcome to Medical Monday. The name of your new book is Attending: Medicine, Mindfulness, and Humanity. And you did a very lovely job of telling us, the readers, why you call it attending and what that word actually means. It has sort of multiple meanings, of course, in the world of medicine. But I was wondering if you could tell us what you mean by attending.
Well, first of all, I'm really pleased to be here with you. And the title, the attending physician, is the person who's in charge of your care. If you're in the hospital, the person who ultimately takes responsibility. But also it refers to a quality of mind, a quality of attention. And it's my belief that what you pay attention to is what you value. And so I really wanted to have both those meanings of this person who's responsible for your well-being, but also this person who's responsible for navigating his or her own interior landscape so that they know that they're attending to the most important things.
I guess I have a conception, even though I still practice medicine, I have a conception of medical professionals, doctors, nurses, what have you, as being all consumed with giving, with altruism, and with, you know, healing and listening to folks. And yet you make it quite clear that it's important for balance and, I think, good health to also pay attention to sensations and motivations of the self, which I think was fairly enlightening for me.
Yeah, it's really, I think the doctors who are the best doctors are the ones who are both knowledgeable and skilled, we kind of take that for granted, but also able to know themselves and self-monitor. So I'll just give you an example. Way back when I was a medical student, I was doing my pediatric clerkship, and sometimes kids would come into the emergency room of the clinic, and my supervisor would say, "Oh, that kid looks sick." Now, what is, you know, I never learned about a diagnosis called "look sick" in medical school. So what are they actually, how do we deconstruct that? How do we understand what they mean when a child looks sick? And it's this global impression that they get. Often it's accompanied by a feeling of dread that you get before you actually take it apart into its components. So maybe it's because the child looks pale, or they're listless, or they're just not acting the way a child that age would act. Maybe they're feverish. Maybe they have a little bit of flush in their cheeks. But it's that kind of intuitive sense that something's not quite right that good clinicians pay attention to.
One of the features that you talk about in the book a great deal, indeed, is something you've spent your career, in a sense, studying and practicing, is mindfulness. And this is something that's come up recently. In fact, on the show just recently, we had Dr. Danielle Ofri, who talks about being mindful in doctor-patient communication. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you would share with us your definition of what it means to be mindful, or how you practice it, or even came to practice it.
Well, mindfulness for me is paying attention on purpose in a way that you can practice more with greater clarity and compassion. At least mindfulness in medicine is what that is for me. It involves seeing things as they are without imposing judgments or interpretations, or at least being able to separate your observations from the interpretations that you place on them. And it has to do with being attentive, curious, present, and adopting what the Zen Buddhists call a beginner's mind, the ability to see a familiar situation with new eyes. So I don't think that these are necessarily innate qualities. I don't think that, you know, we all have little bits and pieces of being attentive and curious and present, but I think we can cultivate those. And when you do cultivate them, it makes you a better clinician. I think it makes you a better person. I think it makes you happier also, because you're able to monitor yourself and know when things are beginning to go the wrong direction just a little bit sooner.
Tell us what you mean by the beginner's mindset, because that was really also quite interesting to me, because I think we're definitely biased, perhaps favorably, toward the idea of knowledge and specialization and the idea that those who know the most are the best experts. And yet you write very movingly about how if practitioners can achieve this beginner's mindset, they're more open to, I guess you could say, new ideas, or to, I think, empathize with suffering, for example.
So I distinguish between experts and masters. So experts know all the answers, and masters are more interested in the questions. They're asking the right questions. And so a good clinician will be knowledgeable and skilled, but a really great clinician will know when they're at their limits of their knowledge, or when there's more than one possibility, more than one explanation. They feel comfortable with uncertainty and ambiguity. And it's not that they're any less knowledgeable, they're just willing to not be certain all the time. I think that's really protective, because medicine is often unclear, and we sometimes pretend that things are clearer than they actually are. And if you keep the door open to possibility, I think you'll be a better diagnostician and also understand people better.
You record several anecdotes, or share with us several anecdotes in the book, of your years of patient care as a family physician and a palliative care physician. One of the patients you write about had longstanding serious mental illness, and you talk about how you knew him perhaps, I think, for 2 decades and had a very sort of transactional relationship with very short answers. And I guess what was it that eventually led you to the relationship to transform a little bit?
Yeah, this was kind of an awakening for me. It really had to do with making assumptions that weren't always quite true. I think this is a guy who's now in his 70s and had been in institutions for much of his life, and probably had been socialized into this very, very passive patient role. I kind of see it this way now. So when he would come to the doctor, he would usually be silent, sometimes was accompanied by an aide or something. I would ask him questions, he would answer the questions, and that would be it. And it seemed like this very impoverished relationship. At one point, he started having side effects from one of his medications. His blood pressure would drop and he would pass out, or nearly pass out. And it was really puzzling as to which of the medications was the culprit. And there was also this concern that if we lowered his psychiatric medications, his mental illness might get worse. And apparently he had been quite, before I'd known him, was quite difficult to manage. So he was agitated and violent at times. And, you know, I was facing this uncertainty, and I said to him, you know, we have this really difficult decision. You're telling me you're nearly passing out quite a bit. That's a dangerous situation. But also, lowering your medications are dangerous, too. And at that point, I expected just a concrete response, and he then said something like, I'm worried, too. And this kind of blew me away, because he had never actually expressed affect or emotions directly. And I realized that I could have a conversation with him about a difficult decision that I previously didn't know had been possible. And just having those conversations opened a door. It made his relationship with doctors different than it had been historically. He became more active in his care and expressing opinions. And also, he smiled more, and I kind of felt that we had developed a bit more of a human-to-human relationship as opposed to this more clinical relationship. So the awakening for me was that sometimes we hold on to these assumptions about people for a very long time. And by adopting a beginner's mind and just saying, well, this is the way things have been for a long time, but maybe this next time they could be a little bit different, in this case, made a big difference.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Dr. Ron Epstein, who is a family physician, a palliative care physician at the University of Rochester. He's also a researcher, writer, educator, who also is a teacher of mindfulness. His new book is called Attending: Medicine, Mindfulness, and Humanity. You also have a chapter in the book called When Bad Things Happen. In it, you reflect on, you know, mishaps in medicine and how it's generally acknowledged that medical error is the source of perhaps close to 100,000 deaths each year. But you are very revealing in sharing your own story of a medical mishap, and I was wondering if you could share that now with our listeners.
Yeah, this was a patient. This was several years ago. A woman who was quite overweight, had diabetes, which had been reasonably controlled for a while, then all of a sudden just became much, much more difficult to control. She was on insulin, and I was increasing her insulin doses and got to a point where I started to feel really uncomfortable. And I had asked her about her diet, which was not great, but not terrible. I asked her about soft drinks. I asked her about other sources of sugar that might be driving her blood sugar up, and I just couldn't quite figure it out. And so I called up a diabetes specialist, and he said that sometimes patients do require very high doses. They have a tremendous resistance to insulin in their fat cells, and so you have to go. When I get to 200 units a day, I start to get very nervous. And he said, well, you know, sometimes he's had people on 400 or 600, and had read about people who were up to 1,000 units a day. So I gradually increased the dose. Still, her blood sugar didn't really seem to budge. It was quite out of control in a danger zone. And so the doses got to be 400, 500, 600, ultimately 800 units a day. Still wasn't getting anywhere, so one of the other suggestions he had was to use a different formulation of insulin, because sometimes people respond differently. So I used a kind of insulin that works a little bit more quickly, not a huge amount more quickly, but it was an intermediate-acting insulin rather than a long-acting. And to be safe, I cut the dose by 4/5. So I gave her 20% of the previous dose, just in case it was a little too powerful. And in any case, the next morning I got a call from the emergency room that she had come in unresponsive and they thought that she had had a stroke. Her blood sugar at home was zero. And clearly, I just had this feeling in the pit of my stomach that I had done something that may well have killed her or caused some serious impairment. Ultimately, she actually recovered fully. She woke up over the next few days. All of her left-sided weakness symptoms disappeared, and you know, eventually. But when I was in the hospital, her husband was visiting her and mentioned to me that she had been drinking up to 6 quarts of sweetened iced tea every day, and what had been happening is that she would drink the iced tea and then follow it up with insulin, and basically she was chasing her blood sugar that way. And but when she took the slightly faster acting insulin, the insulin acted too fast for her to catch up with it, and that's why her blood sugar went to zero. But I brought up this particular case for two reasons. One is there's always some ambiguity around errors. So I wasn't the only doctor she saw. There was an endocrinologist. She saw a nutritionist. I'm sure everyone asked her similar questions about diet and exercise. So there was this, you know, team or network of physicians caring for her. And also, she wasn't revealing. You know, she didn't tell me everything that she was doing. You know, she didn't think to tell me. But still, the feeling of having potentially caused someone's demise is devastating. In medicine, those feelings aren't talked about very much, and medicine is the culture of medicine is highly critical. And so often people, when they make an error or think that they've made an error, have this feeling that they want to hide and not look at it and keep it a secret, but then, of course, it kind of gnaws at you, and I think it affects your practice and also the relationships you have with patients. So I think another aspect of this work of being mindful is learning to recognize your feelings, to try to find some way of turning towards rather than turning away from your errors and bad outcomes so that you can learn from them. And also that there might be a more open dialogue among physicians, a more supportive dialogue compared to what's the norm now.
Have you seen any progress on that front, or do you think that culturally, as a profession, we're getting better?
There is some, because there's a movement afoot towards encouraging physicians to apologize to patients, which I think is often quite therapeutic and seems to also reduce lawsuits. But I think it goes beyond that. It's not apologizing to patients so much as having dialogues among clinicians so that they can then come to peace themselves. And that I don't see happening all that much. We do I do a lot of workshops for physicians in which we have sessions on errors, and many of them bring up things that have happened 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago that they've never told anybody about that are still gnawing at them in some way. It erodes their sense of confidence. It erodes their trust in themselves. So I think there's been a little bit of progress, but not enough.
And with this patient that you mentioned, of course, you had really racked your brain to figure out why it was that her sugar seemed so difficult to control. And you had, of course, asked about common things like soft drinks,
right,
or what have you, but it was this, I guess, omission, if you will, of sweetened tea that was sort of overlooked. But she, you know, answered very concretely that she, you know, wasn't drinking, I guess, sweetened or not sweetened beverages.
Yeah, she was kind of a concrete person. So she answered the questions that were presented to her. She wasn't volunteering a lot. And the reason I brought up this particular case in the book, though, is because of its ambiguity. And I think that most errors in medicine have that quality about them, that they're not clear. I mean, clearly, if you do surgery on the wrong foot or whatever, that's pretty obvious. But so much of the time, it's really hard to, you know, figure out if there's one single cause. Often it's a combination of things that conspire to cause an error.
You focus on the clinician's response to medical error, or how it could be different, or how, in fact, you have coped with it and thought about it and do write very beautifully about it. There's another aspect of medicine that I think you write very well about, which you use the word, I believe, corporatization, which is that medicine has definitely become big business, and many, many physicians no longer are in practice for themselves, but rather we work for large enterprises, in your case, a university, but in many other cases work for hospitals or insurers or large healthcare organizations. And you have seen, you write about one person you call Diane, a colleague or someone you're acquainted with, who is really struggling with the workaday world of modern medicine and feeling like she's on the hamster wheel. And you visit her at first where she's pretty much ready to abandon the profession and then come back and revisit her a little bit later. And I guess if you could share with us her story and then what she did. She made really some small changes but seemed to really make a profound difference.
Yeah, I think her story is kind of like the everyman story these days in medicine, because we can see little bits of ourselves in this. Medicine is fundamentally a human enterprise, and the things that take us away from that often make us unhappy. So there are several things that have happened. One is that medicine's become much more like an assembly line, and because we're working for large organizations, they think of healthcare workers in terms of what they produce. And in this case, they're not so much interested in producing health as producing health services that can be built. So that immediately drives a wedge between the reason that you went into medicine in the first place, which has to do with helping people and knowing people, with activities which often take a significant amount of time that have to do with billing and maximizing the amount of money that you can extract out of each hour of work. And that in and of itself is demoralizing to most clinicians. I think we didn't really go into medicine for those reasons. The second thing is the dialogue in medicine, things that we talk about. So I visited many healthcare institutions and attended departmental meetings, and the dialogue often has very little to do with quality of care and has to do with throughput and productivity. The second really piece has to do with documentation requirements, which means that you spend a lot of time filling out checkboxes to demonstrate that you've done certain things in order to be able to bill for them. And the third has to do with electronic health records, which, for all their advantages in access to information, they drive your gaze as a physician. You're looking at the screen rather than at the patient. So now clinicians spend far more time looking at computer screens than communicating directly face-to-face with people, be it people like nurses and other health professionals or patients. So even communication with colleagues that used to be by telephone or face-to-face is now in the form of internal emails and messages. I think that's alienating. I think most people really want to have a sense that they're connecting with other humans. So I think all of those things have conspired to give physicians this lack of connection. The second piece is a lack of control. So increasingly, clinicians don't have control over their schedules, don't even have control over the art that's put on the walls. So when you're in a situation where you're not doing, or you're doing less and less meaningful work and feeling that you're having less and less control over it, that sets the stage for burnout. The change that can happen, though, by becoming more mindful is realizing what it is that you're missing and trying to make sure that you get as much of it as you can. So on a personal level, for example, when I see a patient, I don't turn the computer on. I give the patient a minute and a half, 2 minutes, maybe a little bit longer, where I'm just talking face-to-face, I'm not taking notes, I'm just really there with the patient. Then I'll turn on the computer to look up lab results or to put in data that I need to, but then try to make the computer a shared enterprise. I show the patient the computer screen. It took me a while to do this, but it and other clinicians certainly have found ways to humanize their interactions with patients that have become more distant. But by being mindful, I'm more aware at a moment-to-moment level when I'm really present with someone and when less so.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today, Dr. Ron Epstein, family physician, palliative care physician from the University of Rochester, also writer, researcher, and trainer in mindfulness. And Dr. Ron Epstein, you have such an interesting sort of career path, and you do so many different things. I guess I'm curious how you developed your pathway. I mean, what led you down your road and into the kind of work that you do that seems so multifaceted and interdisciplinary?
Well, when I was a kid, I wanted to be a doctor, but that was put on the back burner when I was a teenager. I studied music, played the piano and then the harpsichord, and also developed an interest in Buddhism. And I was really quite young when I was like 14 or 15, and learned to meditate when I was 16. First did transcendental meditation, then Zen meditation, because I had the older brother of a friend of mine was a practitioner. And for me, it stuck. It was really, I found it compelling. I found it a way to understand who I am and my place in the world, a way to connect with myself better so that I could connect with people in the world. And then eventually spent some time at the San Francisco Zen Center in the when I was in college. I actually took a semester off and spent a few months there doing intensive meditation practice. Ultimately came back to college, finished my degree, and in my 20s turned back towards medicine because I felt this need to do more work in the world and deal with suffering. I think that was... It was even a little bit more tortuous than that, but I think that that's you know it in a nutshell. But I had these three separate lives, if you will: this life as a meditator, this life as a musician, this life as a medical student, and beginning doctor. And it was only after I'd been in practice of medicine for a few years that I realized that all of these things were connected in ways that I hadn't imagined previously.
How are they connected?
That the state of mind that I would be in when I'm practicing medicine at my best is very similar to the state of mind that I was in when I was giving a good musical performance or when I really felt that I was meditating the way that I was being taught to do, just achieving this state of clarity. It wasn't always a happy clarity, but it was just a sense of clarity of purpose and a sense that I was flourishing. At that point, had a role in the medical school here to assess the competence of medical students and residents. And I thought that people who previously thought about ways to assess doctors only had part of the picture. If you went to a doctor, you wouldn't be very reassured if someone told you that they got a very good mark on their board exam. You want to make sure that if they're a surgeon, they actually have good judgment. They know how to respond to difficult moments, that they have a certain kind of practical wisdom. And I kind of gelled those aspects, those less tangible aspects of what it means to be a great doctor under the umbrella of mindful practice. And described attributes of physicians who were mindful and attributes of physicians who were less mindful, or even looking at myself when I'm at my best and when I'm not quite at my best. And I started writing about it almost as a personal manifesto in the late 90s, and ultimately published an article in JAMA. And when I did that, just got hundreds of letters and emails from other physicians who said, kind of, yes, this is what I aspire to. This is how I am when I'm doing my best. And so I felt really energized by this, that I wasn't alone, that I was really tapping into something that's fundamental, not only about the practice of medicine, but I think any kind of work that puts you in touch with people.
So interesting. So what do you think, when you were a teen, led you into a curiosity about Buddhism or meditation in the first place?
I guess I was always an introspective kid. You know, I'm somewhat introverted, and the literature that I was drawn to, I read a lot of Hermann Hesse in those days, was very popular, and read Siddhartha, and about people going on journeys and discovering themselves and finding some sense of peace in their lives. And for me, this sounded kind of like a premonition of what I might want to do or how I might want to be in the world. That somehow this turning inward and turning towards kind of discovering not only the world outside but the world inside, for me, was exciting. It was, some explorers go to the South Pole, and some people go into the recesses of their own minds. And I actually did a little bit of both of those. I was a traveler and also an explorer in this interior world. So I guess I just found it exciting.
So one last question is, I read this book with sort of two eyes, if you will. One was toward the general audience to whom I think this book would be very useful, and then again as a practitioner, as a practicing doctor, and trying to improve my own practice. But did you write it really mostly for an audience of other physicians, or mostly at the lay public, or certainly both?
I was really targeting the lay public with this book. I mean, clearly it speaks to health professionals. I speak that language. But I've done a lot of that. I've written a lot of articles in the medical literature. And for this, I really wanted to step outside to give the public a sense of what goes on in the minds and lived experiences of physicians, and how reflecting on that and appreciating the complexity and, I would say, beauty of it could make for better healthcare. So, and also, just thinking about when you yourself are sick and going to the doctor, what that interaction is like, and what is it about that physician that enables him or her to help you?
Dr. Ron Epstein, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. If you've missed any of our shows, you can always listen to them online anytime on your smartphone, tablet, or computer. Just go to our website, studiotulsa.org. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.